How are we doing, everybody? And welcome to Crime Theory. Sorry, I just got an error report there from something and just totally threw me off. How are we doing, everybody? Welcome back to the Sean Atwood channel. This is Crime Theory. And of course, I am Ron Swanson and I'm here with John Wedger. And we're going to be delving into another horrific case. And before we get onto that, I hope everyone's had a good week. Big shout out to whatever platform you're watching this on. I hope you're having a good week. John is going to take a phone call. And we'll bring him back in a minute. But yeah, I hope everyone's had a good week. I had an incredible stressful morning this morning. Thankfully, it got sorted. But nothing worse than having your day ruined the second you get out of bed. Nothing worse. Absolutely nothing worse. And this evening we're going to be talking about a guy called Anthony Hardy. And you know, just take a look at this guy. He is, you know, straight off the bat, it is proper heebie-jeebies. But a horrific case and crime. Who have we got in this tonight? We've got Shane, we've got Ray J, Justin. What was Brig? I don't know what that one is. Dodie, what is happening? The only way is crazy media. How are you doing? KPW, how are you doing? Fred, Kaza, William, what is happening? But I've got a few things that I'm working on. I've been trying to do something on a Tuesday. The podcast that I'd had planned is a bit hardcore. Even if you've seen the first episode, we did really well with staying within the algorithm. But even then, we were still giving a slap. Let's see if John's doing. John, how are you doing? Oh, he's still doing his thing. So what else? What else can I tell you before? I don't want to ruin any of the factoids on this. But the last few days here, I'm trying to put together a new series for you guys on a Tuesday with Scientology, all based around that. Scientology survivors, ex-members, all this kind of stuff. Did I blow dry my hair? No. It's a shamble. Right.
I'm back with you now. I had a couple of things I had to deal with, but also, the problems are being busy.
Yeah, well, that's it, mate. That's it. And what have you been up to this week? Tell us a little bit about what's been on your plate.
Yeah. So, very busy week, but I've also what I'm doing, because it's like Holy Week, you know, it's the lead up to Easter. So, what I do once a year, I do like a 7-day fast. So, okay. I've actually been fasting for 5 days now, just drinking tea and water, sort of, really. But I do it once a year, and it's just good for the system, it's good for the mind.
Nothing at all, no food at all for a week.
No. Oh, so I've got a couple of days left till Easter Sunday, and then it's just one of the things. It's tough going. Anyone who's ever done fasting, it's and I don't mean about like the Ramadan fast, because it's actually an abstinence from food, but the first 4 days are very hard going, but after that, your body just kicks in, and the lightheadedness goes, and you get very tuned in. It's not a weight loss thing. I don't do it for that reason. It's just very good. It's a very good thing to do.
I'd be tanning pepperamis under the bed, and as soon as there was possible deniability, I would be 3 days in and just scranning pepperamis and shit, just jerking by that.
Well, maybe at the weekend that'll happen. And the other thing is, we've got our documentary Redemption. So we interviewed our second guest today for it. It's just brilliant. I mean, the first one we did a couple of weeks ago, there's been an issue with venues, but we've managed to get a venue. We've got our second guest in. So if you go on my Patreon, you'll find out who it is. But we'll keep it under wraps the time being. But is that, I suppose you could use the term gangster or whatever, but a very, very well-known sort of face in the UK at one point. But this guy is, if anyone's ever done a U-turn on his life, it's this fella. He's just, he's quite an awesome individual, and it was brilliant. Best one, like I said to you pre-start of this, probably the best interview I've done to date.
Super. Yeah, well, make sure you go and check out the Patreon and find out a little bit more about that. So let's start tiptoeing into this Anthony Hardy case. I mean, I kind of scanned over it, as I always do. I mean, just looking at this guy, I mean, you know, some criminals just have that look around them. And this guy just doesn't look like a good man at all.
No. I chose this one for quite a few reasons. The one thing that's seems quite consistent with the people we've mentioned and that we've looked into, we've investigated on Crime Theory in the last series, Ron, is this, that there's always suspicion that they've committed many, many more murders than they've been convicted of.
Okay.
So when we look at Sidney Cook, they think he could be responsible for many, and not just one or two more, many more. Same with Brian Fields. You know, so it seems to be with these serial murderers that they actually literally get away with murder. Yeah. And what they get caught for seems to be a small percentage of what they've done. And you'd have thought maybe that would be the case for shoplifting and a minor sort of crime. But when you get serious crime like this, how do they do it? You know, they're out there, there are missing people. But when you look at the statistics of missing people, that they're quite horrific anyway. Yeah. You know, it's shocking stats, and some never return. Now, are they the victims of people like this guy? So that intrigued me. The other thing that got me with him was that when he was active, it was circa the same time I was working that area. Okay. On Vice. So I actually did know many girls from the street that had dealings with this fella. And they would discuss it. They'd say, you know, I know the Camden Ripper, and they all said he was a particularly horrible and violent individual. And the thing is, they say get preyed on a lot, the street prostitutes. They call them sex workers now, don't they? But, you know, we know them as Toms, we called them, Thomas Moores. That was rhyming slang. So that they seem to be sort of bait for all these nutters. You know, they get assaulted, they get hard, as we say on this show, a lot. They get beaten up. They, you know, sometimes people would sometimes go to them and sort of open their hearts to.
Okay. Oh no, there we go. Right, John, remember last week this happened. You need to go in and out again. In and out again. That's what happens when John gets a call during the live stream. Nope, still can't hear you, mate. Hang on, let me try this. Yeah, there we go. He's figured it now. So again, we're getting a little bit of backstory here just on this individual, but I mean, imagine being in his area, work in Vice, which is effectively this guy's hunting ground. It'll be interesting to see what John's got to say on it, to be honest with you, because you can't get much closer than that, really. You know, I mean, obviously, apart from being part of the arresting team or whatever, but we'll see. We shall see. Right, so until John is back, let's... There we go. Saved by the wedger. No, he's disconnected. Device is not connected.
That's it. I'm back in. So what happens is because I use the mobile phone, as soon as someone calls me,
you're all right, man.
It allows me in, but then it blanks me out again.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't worry.
So that's one of the problems of lives, I suppose. But that's history. But if we go back to this guy and who is demographic, who his victims were, they were the sex workers in the Camden area, the street girls, and some of those that not that were his victims, because they're not here, but you know, it wasn't just the ones that he murdered, but you know, he also would use their services, and a few of them would tell us about this fella. There was one girl I can remember, she was actually the victim of Peter Sutcliffe. Oh, and wow. she told me, she said Sutcliffe actually abducted her, R'd her, beat her with a hammer, and then I thought this was just a cliche, you know, but he rolled her in carpet and dumped her in a waste ground, and she was still alive. I thought that rolling in carpet was just some sort of urban myth cliche.
Myth, yeah.
Did it to her. She was also the victim of him and the victim of this guy. You know, how much bad luck can you get, or good luck, because she survived both of them.
Yeah.
But the, so that's a couple of points which drew me to choosing him. The other thing, which it gets mentioned in his offending, but they don't properly go into it, was this was his murders. These were ritualistic. This guy did some things, as is going to come out in the disclosure tonight, which clearly indicate that this man is a practicing Satanist.
Yeah.
And I will, like most things, I will back that up with the evidence. And you're right. I mean, if you look at him, you know, okay, that's not a complimentary photo, but he was apparently a very big guy. He was violent. He was just dangerous. And these poor, vulnerable girls, a lot of them are harboring Class A drug addictions. And, you know, and due to that lifestyle, that they're not physically that domineering. They must have had a real frightening hard time with this fella. And especially when you look at what his quirks were, you know, very, very alarming. But so here we have it. Anthony Hardy, born the 31st of May, 1951. Died the 25th of November 2020, apparently from COVID related complications. But
yeah.
You know, he was a big guy anyway. So and you know, prior to his death, he was sentenced to three life sentences for three murders. So he actually had three life terrorists. So he would die in prison. There was no way the Home Secretary was going to release this.
Yeah, you know? No.
There was strong belief, credible belief from the police that as well as the three murders he was convicted of, there was another three that he was closely associated with. So they reckon he was responsible for six murders in total, although again the burden of proof and everything else, you know, it's a difficult sort of hurdle to overcome sometimes. So he's from Burton-on-Trent. And also one of the murders was actually on Burton-on-Trent, and that sort of goes back to the profiling of these people, that when they dispose of bodies, you know, you've got to look at not only how the body is found, but also where it's found. And it could be a big indicator that if they choose a certain spot, that means that there's some sort of childhood connection to that area or somewhere that they feel safe and comfortable in there, which would probably allude to the fact that they know the area very well, have a strong connection with it, and they're sort of confident that whilst they're there, that they're not going to come to notice. But this fellow, for the serious crimes, they occurred between 2000 and 2002, again, in the Camden King's Cross area of London. So this guy was from Burton-on-Trent. Apparently a very intelligent and well-educated man. He had a degree from Imperial College for Engineering. Apparently he was very bright indeed and sort of excelled at school. So he doesn't really come from that. Well, there's not much information regarding his childhood, so we can't gauge what of a background he had. Like so many others, we can sort of look back and see that they'd come from abusive childhood backgrounds, everything else. We don't have that information.
Why don't we have any information on that? Like, why was that?
Again, it's very underreported, and especially in respect to the ritualistic evidence that is involved in this case, which is quite stark. The police didn't really make a big deal of it. And it sort of comes back to something that I've been going on about a long time as a campaigner for justice of survivors of childhood abuse, but also satanic ritual abuse. And it's something which I'm going to go on about some statistics here regarding ritual abuse. And the fact that we are so unlike so many other Western nations who actually see it as an aggravating factor, and some places actually have dedicated ritual abuse investigation units. The South African police has got a very highly successful one. The American forces as well, they have it, and NYPD, you know, that they have it as well. So it's something that the police don't look into. And if we go back, when they start really taking it seriously, so there is some evidence that this has sort of really been pushed forward, and that was a parliamentary review was done, and it was done by someone who was appointed by the government called Eleanor Stobart, and it was looking at how much child abuse was linked to witchcraft and demonic possession. And this is the first time really we see this, and this is in post the death of Victoria Colimbier. And it looked at the frequency and severity of allegations of witchcraft and demonic possession in child abuse and murders. And they found that in 1 year, circa 2005, there were 74 cases clearly linked to demonic possession and witchcraft. So this is the first time really in what I've looked into, apart from sort of the Witchfinder General, is it Matthew Hopkins, when we see officially the government mentioning this, and it predominantly from the stuff they looked at, it came from the Congolese and Angolan communities, but also it was a bit more far reaching, and the majority of these cases were in and around London. And it's something I really want to go into before we started looking at this fellow. And this might explain the reluctance of the police to properly look into it. And this was all reported to the Department of Education and Skills, who were behind the commission of the report, which was sanctioned by the government. And and some of the evidence when they looked into this, when they interviewed some of the survivors of it, there were accounts that kids gave of people changing into animals. There's evidence in written statements going back to astral traveling, and also people cannibalism, eating other people.
Testimonies of survivors.
And this was evidence that came out in other reports from social services and child abuse cases. So they looked at everything. You know, on a minor level, there was beating, burning, cutting, and strangulation. And one of the conclusions was that when you get evidence of abuse cases where it does involve beating, burning, cutting, and strangulation, you should actually start considering that there could be an inference towards ritual abuse. So this isn't some satanic panic nonsense. This was a properly commissioned, government-sanctioned, professional report that was done circa 2005.
That's wild.
How interesting is that? And you know, there's a bit more to it. In the work that I carried out, someone on my request, I commissioned it, I suppose, they put out an official freedom of information request to every single police force in England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales. I think there's about 50 odd, you know, quite a lot anyway. And they said from 2000 to 2022, how many cases of satanic related crime did they encounter, right? So bear in mind, this report was made in, you know, just after Colimbier's death in 2004, right? And they found in 1 year alone, 2005, there were 74 cases. Majority of them were in London. Bear that in mind. Now, I'm going to go through a few stats. You had Bedfordshire said that there were 11. West Yorkshire, they turned around and said that there were 74 cases. Surrey said there were 32. Essex said there were 6. Hertfordshire said there were 44.
Now the
last time stats like this came out was the Witchfinder General Matthew Hopkins, yeah. right? And he actually said that the predominant regions in the UK for witch crime related cases were in Essex and Hertfordshire. Now this intel that I gathered would go a long way to say that. What is very, very alarming about this is when questioned on an official Freedom of Information report, the London Metropolitan Police said they had never had any cases, which is a clear lie because, like I just said, 74 national cases, the majority of them came out of London in an official report of witchcraft and demonic possession related cases.
How can they just deny the data, though? I mean,
I know.
Obviously, not everyone's going to know. Yeah, well, not everyone's going to know these statistics, clearly. But I mean, if they went in with a copy of this report in their hand, it'd be a lot harder for them to deny it. But I mean, that just sounds like a complete. I mean, I don't even know what to say to that.
Well, when the Freedom of Information goes to an official designated desk that deal with it, so it's not like they're just asking a Bobby on the street who hasn't got a clue. This is come from a source that should know. And bear in mind, where did the information for the 74 cases come from? Well, that would have come from Freedom of Information or a unilateral agreement that the forces had to supply this. So at some point, the Metropolitan Police is lying. And I think they're lying in respect to the... But also, if we look at where we did get another official report that was done, okay, it wasn't government sanctioned, but it was sanctioned by a well-accredited professional, and that was the RAINS list, the Ritual Abuse Information Network Support, and that was Dr. Joan Coleman of the Maudsley Hospital, you know, so an NHS professional psychologist, psychiatrist and therapist who compiled a list of names and places to a journalistic standard of people who were involved in satanic ritual abuse, and she names in there 3 members, of which one I worked under, of the Metropolitan Police, another force that was named in the RAINS list, and they had their chief constable and their assistant chief constable as being active Satanists, was Hampshire. Well, lo and behold, when Hampshire was sent a Freedom of Information request on this, they too said they had none, and the same was for David and Powers Police in West Wales, who said the same. And bear in mind, David and Powers, Chief Constable, was also named on the RAINS list. So someone at some point is lying about the reality of this. And this goes to show also when evidence of Anthony, Tony Hardy's offending and his crimes, that evidence to the court showed clearly that was some satanic ritual element to this. They didn't make any correlation or any inference that it had a connection or he was involved in it, which I think was an important factor. Now, another interesting thing was that there was a barrister who had actually escaped childhood trauma and abuse, where parents were involved in Satanism, and she was abused under that satanic ritual sort of environment, and she managed to run away from home and was placed into care and was brought up by adoptive parents, and she went on to become a barrister, and quite a well credited barrister she was, so much so that the Metropolitan Police employed her as a trainer on their detective training school at the world-renowned Crime Academy at Hendon.
Okay.
Now, a place where I worked for a couple of years as a trainer as well. Now, she became an expert in child abuse matters, and she said to people that if there are certain elements, if a body is found at a crime scene or a victim as mentioned, right? And they include what we just mentioned, you know, the burning, the strangulation, boom, 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 and how many of the people we mentioned have done that to their victims. But also, if there is any ecclesiastical element or sites used, you must think that there could be a ritualistic element to this, right?
Of course.
She was well received, and she went a career helping the Met Police and training their detectives, went without incident, until a certain detective who, like I keep saying, I've alluded to this guy many times. One day I will mention him, but legally I'm on tricky ground here, and I don't want to be the man down the well, as the parable says, and I need to carry on doing these things and not be silenced. Oh, this guy crops up all the time when it comes to survivors of satanic ritual abuse. This same ex-detective appears and frustrates matters, let's say, right? Now, lo and behold, this woman was told to stop mentioning these things because of the intervention of this detective, the same guy. His name has been mentioned to me by about 10 different individuals for frustrating any satanic ritual inquiry that he comes across.
You see, and just for those of you who think that perhaps, you know, acting in a way that would disrupt cases would be something that would derail someone's career. We spoke about the case where it was declared as the greatest miscarriage of justice in British history, where that the guy with the mental health issues was jailed for X amount of decades for that.
Stefan Klitschko.
That was
Leslie Mulseed.
Yeah, that was it. And it's shocking, and I don't really get how it's not obvious to everyone what's going on. But I think the scale of it. But like I say, with that individual in the Mulseed case, did he not get promoted after all this and end up?
He got promoted, and he went on to frustrate the Ripper inquiry.
That's right. Just to put it, just so everyone understands, like, we're talking about a system here where people are placed to do these jobs, and you would think that these would be the things that would derail a career, but these are just the things that perpetuate their careers in this scenario.
Well, if you look at the guy who tried to bully me into silence, after that he got promoted to one of the highest positions in the land. You know,
it's freaking scary.
And if we don't think this goes on, just look at how many cases that went through the Vatican's fingers that were frustrated, that were pushed under the carpet, you know, that they would put their own investigators in. Look, we see this time and time again. This is why the police should never be allowed to self-adjudicate. Granted, there are certain protocols that only police know. But then again, there should be certain barristers that are specialised in police protocol, and it won't be too long to work it out. You get the same thing with the general medical council.
Yeah.
You know, they adjudicate themselves, and sometimes they protect their own. You know, and we've got to be naive to think that people won't lie to protect themselves and others or their friends, because they will, and they always have done. It's human nature.
Well, this is what I think people find hard to believe. So, we can all sort of apply the protecting our mate scenario to something, but when we're dealing with such a moral, like traumatic subject, these individuals are 100% protecting those that are in their circle within the like-minded PDF file club, shall we say?
Yeah.
Because. Sorry, I'm struggling with my camera. Here we go.
I think that's a good term to use, PDF.
PDF was a good one. But this cannot exist without a massive, massive web of these individuals.
Of course.
Legal system to the government. The only way any of what we're talking about makes sense is if that's what's going on.
Well, if we sort of divulge into this guy, you will see that there's been some massive monumental failings which allowed him to get away with murder and commit more murders. I mean, he looks like his early years was quite high functioning. Didn't really come to notice. He got married and he had four kids. He moved to Australia and he ended up in Tasmania for some reason. He was arrested in Tasmania because he was trying to drown his wife. Wow. Again, drowning. Again, it's not good, but you know, when you see ritual abuse, burning and drowning and strangulation, the element, you know, well, especially burning and drowning, elements of nature, they'd used a lot. So the bodies could be found burnt and then chucked in water. And you've got to consider ritual abuse. And we found that with the Brian McDermott case that we mentioned, where his body was torched. Yeah. And it was, submerged again, the other thing is mutilation. Yeah. You know, the need to mutilate and then drowned. And we're sort of, we're in that ballpark with this guy. His wife in 1986, she actually divorced him. And he ended up in coming back to UK, but spending a lot of times in various mental health institutions and hospitals, and was diagnosed with bipolar depression, drug psychosis and alcohol abuse. So he was abusing drugs, and that affected him long term mentally. He was alcoholic and with bipolar, and a big, strong, angry guy. In 1998, he gets arrested again, but this time we're sort of getting more to near his offending. A prostitute accuses him of the R word. So, a street prostitute. So really, I mean, I know it sounds a bit judgmental, but for a prostitute to allege that someone has done that to him, it's got to be quite alarming to them, because, you know, their tolerance is a lot higher than anyone else's, because it's an occupational hazard for them.
And how serious would the police have taken a sex worker saying, I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, not that serious. I have taken a statement from a street girl that made an allegation, and we did try and pursue it, but there's a lot of factors that go into it, and it almost renders it too difficult to prosecute. But that's not saying it doesn't, because it does happen.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're opening themselves up to be attacked monumentally by the defence.
Of course. Yeah. You know, I mean, really, that's the thing, and it sucks, because I mean, just to think how much of this could have been prevented if the circumstances were a bit different. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, it's he's coming to notice, this guy, okay? He's definitely predatory and dangerous.
Yeah, of
course. And the pattern's already there. You know, he's a wife. We mentioned about domestic violence perpetrators last week, and the damage that they cause and the damage that they harbour within themselves. And this guy is a domestic violence perpetrator. He's now an R man. And his target seems to be prostitutes. He's got mental health issues. He's got psychosis. He's got bipolar, and he's an abuser of alcohol. So it's not boding too well. So yeah. In January 2002, he lives at the back of like St Pancras Station, between St Pancras, Mornington Crescent, that sort of way. Camden anyway. It comes under Borough of Camden, but it's quite an impoverished. Inner city area, very, very busy inner city area. Most of the housing there is, if it is council, it's flats, you know, so it's not too many high rise, but like the old tenement.
Yeah, yeah, with you.
4 to 5 story sort of buildings, and he's in one of them. Anyway, he gets the police are called to his flat, because what he'd done is it poured some sort of acid or something over his neighbor's door. So he was bullying his neighbors. So, you know, this guy was coming to notice the local authority. They did nothing. And he was intimidating anyone who dared criticize this guy. And he pulled some corrosive substance over their door. And the neighbors had called the police, and the police came round and decided to knock on his door. Anyway, they found his door open. And when they went in there, they found a dead, naked prostitute. And she had cuts and bruises to her head and her body. Again, if we look at what we, like I said at the beginning of this interview, with the ritualistic stuff, you know, the beatings, you know, the cut-ins and all that, you know, could indicate ritualistic, but it could indicate many other things. But it got to keep an open mind here. Her body is splayed out in a crucifix position. And not only that, she is wearing a devil mask. So a mask of a devil is put
right,
on.
They did, like, so they just stumbled upon this. So this, whatever, like, was, whatever has happened to that woman,
yeah,
this is just her, this is her mid-setup after yeah. she come to her demise, and this is what the police have found.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. His flat contained daubings of a satanic nature on the wall. They later found pieces of skin and flesh nailed to his wall. And some of the daubings were written in blood, right? They find this prostrate, battered street prostitute with her arms splayed out. Bear in mind the lessons that they should have learned from the Yorkshire Ripper case.
Yeah.
And she's got a satanic mask on, right?
Do we know anything and else about the mask?
Obviously, it was a devil mask. So it's like a devil, a red devil man's face. So if you've got the typical, like, a devil, red devil,
yeah,
with the horns.
Was it like, did it look like something you could have just ordered on Amazon, or did it look like more?
I don't know where it comes. It's
elaborate quite piece.
There is an image of it online. So it's sort of like a full face man's face. It's like a rubber mask with this sinister grin, red with these two horns. Right? You know, it seems quite an ambiguous, an unambiguous mask. So you couldn't say it was Pan or it was some sort of pagan deity. It clearly looks.
Yeah, it's more how elaborate and how high quality the mask was, because yeah. he doesn't look like the sort of guy that would, for any reason, have anything other than something you could get from a shop. So it'd be intriguing if it was some elaborate piece or something. It was like hand carved out of wood or something like this, just because I think that ties in more likely that he's been given this for a purpose, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So her name was Sally Rose White, and she also had bite marks all over her body. Now this is where it gets really interesting. So he gets arrested for a murder. He denies it, and he's let go. And do you know the reason why? The pathologists then states that this girl died from one thing and one thing only. She had a heart attack.
But is there not laws against messing with someone's dead body? She's had a heart attack with the mask on and then fallen dead into a cross shape.
Well, of course, once this guy's made this, you know, there was no second post-mortem. It was not put up for an appeal or anything like that, except it now. Here's where it gets really weird. Because the pathologist was a guy called Freddie Patel. Now, Freddie Patel, a couple of years later, in 2009, he's got a series of bizarre conclusions. Well, most of them that come his way, he just says they died of heart attack. And more, the one that really nailed him was the death of Ian Tomlinson. And Ian Tomlinson was the protester in 2009 at some sort of anti-government protest. I think it was like a semi-vagrant-y type, Ian Tomlinson, and he actually sort of antagonises the British Transport Police, who decide to sort of batter him to death. And it's caught on camera. He's taken a proper sticking off the rozzers, as we should say. And Freddie Patel turns around and says, yeah, Ian Tomlinson died of a heart attack. And when they look, because he had actually lied to the GMC, so he had to be part of some sort of special medical group in order to qualify as a pathologist and carry on working. He lied and said he was in a group where he wasn't. I don't know the full terminology, but you can get it online.
Yeah.
So he'd actually made it up and they'd accepted it, which allowed him to practice. Bear in mind, pathologists are top of the tree here. You know, we're not talking a GP. These are top of the tree. They deal with the coronial side, and the coroner is the highest court in the land. And it looked like Freddie Patel, for many years, had really come to notice amongst his peers as being totally incompetent and had put every death down, virtually, literally, figuratively or whatever, as being a heart attack. So they didn't question him. The fact that this girl is in the house of a man who commits ours on.
Oh yeah, but I mean, that's what I was going to say. If we've got all of these previous statements, and it's clear that they're just given a public cause of death to just eliminate all of the finer details. Yeah. You know, if it goes from an unknown death to suddenly a heart attack, people are like, okay, well, fair enough. They're not going to start scratching the surface. But those are some pretty hefty details to not be focusing on.
Yeah, of course. It's really, really worrying. And they accepted it. And they thought nothing of it. He was released from the court. You know, the body's got bite marks on it, been battered. Is laying naked with a mask on it, with a devil. There's satanic daubings on the wall. And it's a case of nothing to see, please move on. And they do. And the most incompetent pathologist, who later gets struck off and gets classed as just an absolute a joke in his industry, Freddie Patel. You know, you only got to look at this man. He's just... there's been a catalogue of F-ups with him in high-profile cases as well. These aren't just Mickey Mouse stuff. These are big cases.
How can they keep getting away with this? How can they keep putting people in place that are going to do things they should get fired for, or do things that should raise serious question in the public eye? Why is there not a lawyer or something that has tried to take all this down? Would he just Go through a tunnel, hit a wall.
It doesn't make any sense. None of it makes any sense.
It doesn't. It only makes sense when you apply this to it. When this theory is in place, that's when it makes sense.
Because when you look at it on the bigger picture, but so this guy, they actually section Hardy, right? He gets sectioned.
Okay.
And even when he's sectioned, a report is made that this man is a danger to the public, and he gets released. So bear in mind all of this, he gets released, right? So he's released in 2002, a little bit later in that year, he's released. And lo and behold, dismembered body parts of two separate prostitutes, street prostitutes in the same area, are found in bins in the environs of his flat. So we've got Bridget McLennan and Elizabeth Vallad. Their bodies were found, minus the heads and the hands. Now,
I was just watching. I swear to God, I was just watching, a body cam thing today of a kid who killed a homeless guy and cut off his head and hands and took them home with him.
Yeah, and if we look at Fred West, the hands would be cut off the bodies. If we look at Brian McDermott, dismemberment, beheading, the same pattern is emerging. Now, granted, if you take off someone's head and a hand, like rudimentary identification can be difficult. But these are street prostitutes. Let me tell you something for the uninitiated, right? A career criminal, a serious career criminal, could probably clock up about 30 convictions, right? For violence, robbery, and things like that. You know, because they'll get caught and they end up going inside, that'd be a lot. It wasn't uncommon for some prostitutes to have up to 500 convictions, 500. And each time they're convicted, they're a bit different with them. But on the whole, there is a need to take DNA and fingerprints, because it was well underway since the late 90s. DNA in and fingerprinting has been underway since 1903.
During this time, then, a percentage of these, you know, beheadings and that cutting off of the hands was like a simple, removing a dental records and removing the fingerprints to a certain extent.
If DNA wasn't in existence, it would be a problem. But bear in mind, like I said, these are girls with a horrific criminal history, what we used to call disposal history. So they wouldn't be like standard criminals. A criminal might get caught one in every 100 times, whatever. These girls would probably be picked up by vice patrols, which I was part of, on a nightly basis. They would get caught, they'll be taken into the police station, they'd be charged, they'd be bailed out, and they'd go to court, get a £50 fine, which they'd have to earn by prostituting anyway. So it just seemed that you was encouraging them by nicking them. So it was a system that didn't work, but that was the game back then. So they were all incredibly well known. And these girls would go missing because you would talk to them. There'd be a list of active street prostitutes, and you'd say, I haven't seen so-and-so. And the other girl said, no, we haven't seen them either. And it was always a worry that they'd been killed because it was an occupational hazard for them. They would get killed. They got picked on by a lot of people. But bear in mind, this guy's propensity for violence towards women and street prostitutes, and you know, and now, you know, a dead one was found in his flat, and now body parts of two more. Now, I don't know what the rationale of the local police were, but bear in mind, that part of Camden is an active, historic, prolific red light area. Women's torsos that turn up, there's a good chance they're probably going to be street prostitutes. There's a good chance. It doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to work that one out. Again, not much has gone on. A little bit before, there was a girl called Zoe Parker. And her body, dismembered body, was found in the Thames down near Brentford. You know, there was intelligence linking Hardy to that. And you know, I've looked into the Zoe Parker murder, and there seems to be some very, very ritualistic stuff regarding Zoe Parker and her body. Her family, a member of her family actually contacted me not so long ago and asked if I had any information on what had occurred with their... a family member, and I said it does seem to have the hallmarks of some sort of ritualistic killing. And then when I found out only the other day that the police had actually linked Hardy in to Zoe Parker's dismembered torso in the Thames, I was quite shocked, but it made sense. And there was also a similar case of two other street prostitutes found near Burton-on-Trent.
Can I just ask, when you interviewed the survivors of this guy, and you maybe have heard more testimonies and things, was there anything ritualistic or violent or suspicious, or like, what was their MO of him if they were being asked?
They would just say that, you know the Camden Ripper, and you'd say, yeah, well, I knew him, he was horrible, he was violent. We would warn the other girls about him. So they would share information amongst their community. And you see, you would work mainly on nights on the streets with these girls. And you did have a working relationship. Some of them weren't very nice, they were anti-police. But others, they were just surviving the only way they knew how. And they were pleasant company. You know, there was a couple of them that were really, really nice individuals. But you had your job to do, and they did it. And you know, they would help you as well with stuff. One of the things that most of them, not all of them, some of them were nasty, sinister women, but a lot of them would help you if they knew that there was a young girl on the street, because they at one time were that young girl on the street. Yeah. But what is even more alarming, right, was what they found in Hardy's flat. They found... the flat was covered in Celtic crosses and cruciforms. Now, I don't know what a cruciform is. I don't know if...
Is that not an upside-down crucifix?
I'm not sure, but it was covered in it. They found slithers of dried skin and flesh nailed to the walls. There were blood smears and daubings, satanic daubings, blood-smeared ones on the walls. He would even, I think, you know, with this first girl... he'd even videoed her.
So if there's chunks of flesh on the wall, right, we have to imagine that those chunks have come from people that are no longer here, right?
Yeah.
So was there any notes on how many bits, how many chunks there were?
No. It was all pretty much a by the way. You know, there was videos of him abusing his first victim, videos of it. And he was addicted to extreme sadomasochistic pornography. And he would hold parties with like-minded sickos, and they would sit there and they would just binge watch hardcore, violent, satanic pornography.
Just remind us of the date of these crimes. Like, when would he be having these parties?
2000 to 2002. So it was all around that time, and every single victim, they reckon, when they found the videos, that he dressed them up, videoed them, and put these masks on them, right? So eventually, he did come under suspicion, right? And he did a runner, right? He went missing. So it seems to be quite evident that it was him. You know, he went on the missing list. And this is when they really started looking into it. And they went down and they searched his flat properly. I think they spent something like 14 days in his flat. And again, there was no official, apart from the evidence that's been disclosed, which for me clearly shows some sort of twisted satanic mindset, that they haven't made any real correlation with it. There was blood everywhere. It was all over the place, and it seemed to be that he'd killed them in his bedroom, filmed it, put these satanic masks on them, laid them out in a cross. Again, it's so satanic, the whole thing is. And then he took them into the bathroom for dismemberment, and then he tried to, they never found the heads of the two girls, never found the heads.
So what did he have to say for himself? Like, what did he have to say for himself? Like, when he was interviewed?
He made no comment. He made no comment. So he was eventually charged with the murders of Bridget McLennan and Elizabeth Vallad. He goes to trial. Now, here's the interesting thing. He goes to trial, and at the start of the trial, he decides to admit to it. So he says, yeah, okay, I'll. He went no comment, and he was resisting the police. When the police actually did track him down, he was found cashing in his prescription at the local University College Hospital in Euston, which is probably less than a mile away. An off-duty copper recognised him because he got circulated as being wanted, and he was a diabetic, probably as a result of his heavy drinking or whatever. So he was seen and the off-duty copper then calls through for assistance, keeps him under observation, two local plod turn up, and he chins one of them, knocks him out, and the other one, he tries to remove the man's eye. They have a full-on fight, and yeah, so he proper kicks off. I think he stabbed one of them in the hand as well. So he stabbed the copper, he battered both of them.
Was there any more talk of, like, any more skulls or bones?
No. When you listen to what bit of footage there is, they did record, put some of the footage that they made it public domain. There was nothing public domain that sort of alludes to the fact that this man is worshipping the devil, where he clearly is. As an interviewer, as a specialist interviewer, and they would have used people like myself to come and interview, it would have been a topic I would have pursued. Especially if the guy's making no comment, you know, you're pretty much free to do what you want then. If they make no comment, well, it was happy days on a serious case like this, and I would have loved it. And the evidence for me would have pushed me into a line of questioning, which would have gone down the lines of witchcraft, Satanism. The mask would have been asked. I would have asked him what his belief system was. Does he believe in Jesus? Does he believe that it was wrong? Does he believe in Satan? Does he... And again, there's no evidence public about what was on the many, many videotapes. Now, we see the same thing happen when 900 to 1,000 homemade porno tapes were found in possession of the Fred West and the Rose West. The West, they were in possession of them, homemade porno films. And there were rumours that in the porno sharing club he was in, that there were local police officers, and not one of the videos in an official reports was ever viewed in the West case. Again, there's nothing that's been made public about really the sheer extent of what was on these videotapes, apart from the fact that there was some video footage that he'd both photographed and videoed these girls laying prostrate, crucifix style.
Can I play devil's advocate for a second here, right? Could we not argue? Obviously, we can, right? And we know what the truth is, right? But could we not argue that he could have been seen himself as a holy warrior, right? She was found in a cross. Maybe he was killing the devil, right? The horns. Cleansing the streets, right? Could we make that argument? I think when we get into the realms of the flesh nailed to the wall, we probably lose a bit of the holy warrior argument, right? And the only reason I'm saying that is it's so bizarre, these cases, John, right? And it's so comforting to have a bullshit analogy like the one I've just given that crumbles crumbles away all of the secret P-word. Yeah.
It's a reasonable line of inquiry. Look, when you're interviewing and making no comment, you've got to look at these things. You've got to look, right? What you've got to look at is lawful excuses.
Yeah.
Right? Were these women trying to kill him? Was he doing this in self-defense? Was he under duress? Did someone make him do it? Yeah. Was he mentally ill? Were the voices telling him to do it? Right? There's lawful excuses for murder. Right? We can kill someone and get away with it lawfully.
Oh, well, she had a heart attack, remember? I take it back. She had a heart attack, that lady, apparently.
We're going to come onto that in a minute, right? So you look at what's a reasonable lawful excuse, but then you've got to look at what could be possible mitigation. And what you said could be possible mitigation.
Yeah.
But did they explore it? Well, there's no record that they did. Yeah. They should have done, because when they make no comment, you've got unlimited avenues you could pursue. And let's look at let's look at the police caution.
I think it's better for the PDF file club to say nothing, right? If they tried to string it so that we're like, right, let's make this as least devilly as possible. Let's put the holy warrior, you know, thing out there. I think that would draw way more attention to this.
Yeah, of course, and it's the police's job to look into that. But look at the caution. The caution covers it.
Yeah.
Like, the caution is a bit like when you sign for a credit card. You're like, well, I didn't realise they charged me so much. Well, you were told. You just didn't take the notice. Yeah. And again, it always comes up with these adverts. Terms and conditions apply, and they rattle it through as quick as they can, and it comes across in text like that. And it's up to you. They've told you, but you don't listen.
Yeah.
You do not have to say anything. He's got the right to say nothing.
But it may harm
your defence if you do not mention when questioned.
Yeah.
Right, something which you later rely on in court. So it's the police's job to close those evidential pathways that he could choose at court to explore.
How did Fred West act? Did he act in a similar way?
Hanging in his cell in Gloucester Prison.
Well, no, I know that, but when he was, did he give any, like, did he, you know, give no comment?
Yeah, I think he sort of blamed Rose, and Rose blamed him. You know, and it's, there was a denial between the two of them, you know.
Because he was alive for a bit, right, in prison. How long did he...
Yeah, he was on remand, and then he hung himself in Gloucester Prison.
Because I feel like as long as you play the rules and you say no comment and you kind of go into your sentence, you're not going to wind up like the man on the island or West, if that makes sense.
But at some point, you've got to account for it. So if you do not mention when questioned, something which you later rely on in court. But what anything you do say may be given in evidence, so it covers it all. And what happens if you do not take that first opportunity, which is usually in the police interview, to account for something which the police are going to ask you about, which you might later rely on in evidence in court, what can be drawn is a legal inference, a common sense decision by the judge that you had a chance. Why are you telling us in court? You was asked by the police fairly, with every avenue covered, to account for it. You refused to do it. Therefore, we are going to draw an inference. We're going to make a common sense decision here, members of the jury, that this man is a liar. And you cannot trust what he says, because he had a chance to say that, and he's used this gap between interview and this day of first day of trial to come up with an excuse to fit himself. So making no comment can benefit to a certain degree, because it's the police's job to provide evidence so you can account for yourself, but only with full disclosure of the evidence, right?
Yeah.
In the absence of evidence, you should always make no comment. But if you make no comment and the evidence has been provided, be careful, because you could have to made a trap for yourself.
Yeah.
But what happens is he, you know, again, the jury's got to adjudicate on this. You know, if look, if you're up in court and you haven't killed someone and they're saying you've killed someone, are you not going to defend yourself? It's everyone's right to defend themselves and say, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I just didn't do it. You wouldn't say mute and say nothing. It just, the only time you would get that would be in an immigration deportation case where someone's coming to this country and they refuse to tell the police where they've come from.
Yeah. See, so, I
you can't deport someone to a country of your choice. You know,
yeah, I just wanted to throw that analogy out there because I feel like newspapers and, you know, people that report on these things in the public, they like to sensationalize a lot of things, you know, and when they always seem to leave out the satanic part along the way, I just wanted to sort of throw an idea at you that could have been another perspective that wasn't even something that was explored publicly or anything. Do you see what I'm saying?
I just
in case, because somebody said
I was saying
the devil there. That wasn't
what you're doing is right. What you're doing is right, Ron. What you're doing is you're exploring a reasonable doubt. And it's the police's job to prove beyond that reasonable doubt. So it's only right.
Yeah.
And as a defense lawyer, you should be exploring a reasonable doubt. And if the police haven't covered it, it's their failing.
It's just fascinating to me that the PDF file satanic group, right, would rather have nothing being said than push for a narrative that steers completely away from their group, if you see what I mean. Because
his interesting thing. So he goes to trial and he decides, yeah, all right, I'm going to tell him that I did kill Bridget McLennan and Elizabeth, right? I did kill Elizabeth Valadad. I did kill him. And then he turns around and says to the judge, but I also killed Sally White. So the girl who had a heart attack and had nothing to do, he then turns around and said, I killed Sally White. How embarrassing is that?
Did he say how he killed her?
No, but he said
because
he killed
her. All I'm saying, right, is if he's like, well, you know, I cut her in half, right? That's pretty much, I mean, how do you say it was a heart attack if there was that much trauma? Like, if there was something that was there. I wonder if he said that as like a, I feel like that was him taking a jab
or
I really do.
And bear in mind, this is a highly intelligent individual, you know, it's a clever man, you know. And so this case, it's and I'll tell you why I come across this. There's a guy who does a lot of looking into ritualistic things throughout the UK. He does a lot of COBOL, but he's great. And he said, you know, why is it all the cases come from America? I said, look, they don't. I said, it just doesn't get reported. It's in plain sight. Look at the case of Thomas Hardy. He went, I never heard of him. I said, go back and look at it. And he come back to me.
Do you know what it is? It's just, that's where Hollywood is. Let's be honest. Like we think all, I mean, it's one of the most common misconceptions. If I tell everybody here to imagine in their head what a serial killer in America looks like, based off what you've seen in the news and the reporting, you would be so wrong. Okay, that's all I'm saying. And just on the subject of that, Sean just done an interview today with Delmas Colvin, with Phil Chalmers from Maximum Security Prison, you know, convicted serial killer. So that'll be out this week. And I think I'm going to set up a Q&A night with Phil, because I think a lot of you will have some questions. But it's interesting because I've spoken to Delmas a couple of times, John, right? And he's the sort of individual that you would meet in a pub or like a bar, have a pint with, have a chat with, and you'd go home and sit down and watch a movie, and he may just kill a hooker on the way home. Do you know what I mean? But you forget he's the only one of the only ones that I've spoken to out of all the serial killers that you forget you're talking to a serial killer.
I think
do you know what else? He was one of the only guys that never ever decided to kill anybody, woke up one day wanting to kill. It was when anyone was rude to him, that's who would get it. And it's, if there's ever a lesson to be learned from Delmas Colvin, he is the reason why you should be polite and nice to people, okay? Because you never know who you're going to pee off, and he's a prime example of it.
I know it's a bit like road rage, isn't it? People bibbing and they don't know who's in that car. They really have no idea.
Well, he was a long distance truck driver, and since he already had a dead girl in the back of his van, he thought he may as well start transporting various chemicals and powders and plants for various cartels. Because if he's already got a dead chick in the back of the van, what's a bunch of medication, shall we say?
I'm going to give you an example. I was partnered up for about 2 to 3 years with an ex-special forces guy. And he was a skinny guy. He was a little bit taller than me, but very skinny, an older man, and very quiet, very unassuming. And one day we was in the East End of London, and we were plainclothes patrols, and we come across something, and there was a group of about 10 to 12 local lads, and they had a habit of ganging up really because the police had brought in single patrolling, and they were warned, don't do it, don't do it. And they brought in, and probably one of the most highest crime areas in the UK, the East End of London. And the local lads decided just to bully the coppers so that the police would turn up, and they were actually attacking, the single patrolled uniformed officers. And we were out one day, and we parked up our little CID car, and this gang sussed out we were detectives.
Yeah.
And one of them spat on the car, the back windscreen of the car. And this guy was, we said, right, who's done that? And they just laughed at him. They went, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? Well, they wish they hadn't. This guy, honestly, he wiped the floor.
Yeah.
Well, and they had no idea. And you should have, and those that sort of made it, they ran screaming. But he really went to work on them, and they realized then who he was, you know.
Yeah. One more thing I wanted to say before we wind down, John, right? Is, have you heard that the new digital exposure laws have come into play? We've seen the first group of individuals. So now in the UK, which is fantastic, if you receive unsolicited pictures of somebody's bits, whether it's lady bits or boy bits, 2 years in prison.
Wow.
Don't pass go, straight to prison, 2 years. So finally, okay, because honestly, it sounds... maybe in some places they might sound ridiculous or whatever, but finally, right? I'm just saying, finally, you wouldn't walk into Starbucks and just whip it out and slap it on the table.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm really ecstatic about it.
Yeah, and a few people have contacted me and said, look, I've received, these pictures. What do I do with them? You know, they're worried.
Here's another thing, though. I think we're going to see a new era of blackmail. Right? Yeah. Where a crazy partner is going to pick up your phone, right? And just load something into a DM and be like, listen, I'm not being funny. Comply or we send this.
Someone contacted me the other day, and their son had been on some online chat thing. Yeah. And basically been groomed. And they made out they was a girl. They made out, so I'm just going to turn around there. Made out there was a girl, and they turned around. Sorry, I'm just going to get myself there just to...
that's right, mate.
Which way do I go? Sorry about that. It's just one of my buddies. You go the wrong way with these things. And then said, we'll send you some pictures. You send us some pictures. Which he did, and then it was a scam. They then tried to blackmail him.
Yeah,
and he could have. He luckily went and told his mum, and she went and got the police. But you imagine if it was someone who was vulnerable, they could have killed themselves.
There has been huge, traumatic, horrendous cases of teenagers in Scotland killing themselves over this.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, listen. We've kind of
let's take this a bit further. Look at the allegations that have been made against Puff Daddy. Apparently, that's what he was doing.
listen, I want to delve into Puff Daddy because that is wild, okay? Wild. It really, really is. There's another case as well I might do some research on and talk about next week, which is actually my high school history teacher. The other high school history teacher in my high school that was cut up and found in bins all around Gilmerton. I can't remember the name of the street in Edinburgh, because he liked to take some of the students home for studying and drug them up and do horrible things to them. And insane dude found out about it and sawed him up into bits house and stuck him in bins.
Well, I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. I'm surprised at the audacity of some of these, how they get away with it.
This went on for years.
Yeah, without that sort of retribution, a case not so far from where I am at the moment, and a guy, a school teacher, quite a retired, well-known, well-respected school teacher, got an axe shoved in his head.
Yeah.
And they arrested a labourer, a builder on the local building site, and said this is some crazed, coked-up builder who'd stuck this axe in a decent member of society. My mate was the investigating officer on it, and he said it went out. The local community was shocked and appalled by this barbaric attack. He said it's only when you actually interviewed the guy. He said he was a nice fella, and he said it turned out that the man had been murdered, used to work in a boarding school, and had been abusing the young boys. One of them, which was this fella, and this guy struggled for years with addiction and everything else. He went to prison because of the violence. He learnt bricklaying in prison. He managed to put his life on track and rebuild his life. Everything was going good. Got a job in London on this building site. And one Friday, as he's packing his tools out, he looks and who does he see? This guy.
You can understand that.
The school teacher, they can spin it, a decent member of society dismembered on that, but we don't know the full story.
Well, that is it. And listen, sadly, I need to go and cook my missus and myself some dinner. My stomach is going crazy. I know you're fasting, right?
Fasting till Sunday and then breaking
fasting
it.
Till Sunday. But I bet, like, double packet bad boy. Do you know what I'm saying? You should do? Go to the baker's and get a fresh loaf of bread, but get them to slice it lengthways instead of widths, right? And then you just get these huge, big bits of bread, grill them up, and just make yourself a monstrosity.
Call it a bacon pillow, you know?
Exactly. Get all the food groups in there, do you know what I'm saying? Get some eggs, get some chickens, get some freaking, get some pork in there, get all that good stuff.
I love bacon. I love it.
Triple pack.
I could never be in a religious group that didn't eat it. I couldn't.
Well, that's it. I don't know why they make animals so delicious. If they weren't but there wouldn't be an issue. You know what I'm saying?
There's no religion that doesn't eat, that refuses to eat whelks, is there,
Well, exactly. I'm not being funny, right? But whelks freak me out.
They're horrible.
I love mussels. I love all the sea creatures are delicious as well. But some of them are basically just snails, okay? I'm all right with snails. Snails cooked properly are all right because they really just taste of 14 cloves of garlic. That's really what snails taste like.
Jelly deals.
Listen, I'll keep you guys posted on the Tuesday show. The one that I had planned was a bit hardcore, and I've got another one that I'm planning. But until then, I might just try and pull people in. If there's nothing going on a Tuesday, I might just pull some people in for some chats that are friends of the channel and do more of like a chitty chatty show on a Tuesday with everybody. But we'll be back here next Thursday, 8 o'clock for the next episode. And listen, thank you everybody for being here. Who has won this evening? Twitter has smashed it again. 540 people on Twitter live right now. 2 people on Facebook. Big shout out to Facebook. How are we doing? What's happening, Facebook? And 156 on YouTube. So we are smashing it. And listen, thank you everybody for being here. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you are ready for this week's content. There's a whole bunch of, next week's content and this weekend's content, I should say. Come and join me tomorrow night for Royal Mess. John, thank you as always. Thank you for watching. Leave a like. Subscribe. Make sure you share.